From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Somos y seremos uno más en la marcha.
We are and will be just one more person in the march.
The Zapatistas march into Mexico City, demanding rights for indigenous people and all poor Mexicans. We'll have a report from the Capitol. Then critical resistance comes to New York. Close to 3,000 people attend an activist conference to organize around the prison industrial complex. We'll hear from Angela Davis and others. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Masked Zapatista rebels urge passage of an Indian rights bill after riding triumphantly into the heart of Mexico's capital in a march supported by the president and welcomed by more than 100,000 cheering supporters. Fulfilling a vow in their declaration of war 7 years ago, the rebels entered Mexico City on Sunday. They assured they had no intention of seizing power. We will move to that story in just a few minutes. Angry Northwest Airlines workers will take their protest to the gates of the White House this morning. They blame President Bush for the failure of talks between the airline and its mechanics union. The two sides couldn't reach a contract settlement by a midnight Eastern time deadline, but because Bush has ordered an emergency board to get involved in the dispute, the possibility of a strike has been pushed back to mid-May at the earliest. Bargainers had reached tentative agreement on some sections of the contract by late Friday, but still can't agree on the key issues of wages, back pay, and pensions. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of a Reagan-era anti-labor action, the nation could be facing a shortage of air traffic controllers during the next decade. The National Air Traffic Controllers Association predicts that half of its workforce, some 7,500 controllers, will retire by the year 2010. A Justice Department study says African Americans and Latinos are twice as likely as whites to report the use of force in encounters with police. The report also says African American drivers are more likely than whites to be stopped, searched, handcuffed, or ticketed. The Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics says 2% of blacks and Latinos who had face-to-face encounters with police in 1999 reported force or threatened force. That compares to just under 1% among whites. The report adds, however, that while the figures show black drivers are stopped more often than whites, that, quote, is not necessarily evidence of racial profiling. The Bush administration will delay action on parts of its plan to channel more government money to religious charities until it can quiet some of the surprisingly vehement opposition to the program. The White House expected church-state separation groups to object to the program, but it didn't expect a chorus of doubts from religious conservatives such as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and even Marvin Olasky, one of the program's early architects. They worried the churches would be corrupted by government regulations or that objections sects would be rewarded. Colombia's second largest guerrilla group has suspended discussions with the government in apparent protest of a U.S.-backed military operation to wipe out drug crops. Peace advocates urge them to resume talks. The National Liberation Army, which has been fighting the government for more than 3 decades, broke off discussions Friday that were aimed at beginning formal peace negotiations. Washington is backing Colombia's anti-drug campaign with a $1.3 billion aid package that includes military hardware and training for Colombian counter-narcotics troops. They have been criticized, the U.S. government, for supporting the human rights-abusing military of Colombia. The drug crops are guarded by rebels and right-wing paramilitaries, which earn millions of dollars a year from the nation's narcotics industry. The Bolivar fumigations began last month when low-flying airplanes backed by helicopter gunships began spraying herbicide on crops of coca, the raw ingredient of cocaine. Sprayings launched last December in southern Colombia have destroyed some 72,000 acres of coca, but they have also killed food crops, caused illness, and left farmers with no other source of income. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan toured a squalid camp sheltering tens of thousands of Afghan refugees in Pakistan, trying to convince the world to help in Afghanistan's humanitarian crisis despite anger over the Taliban's destruction of historic statues. About 70,000 refugees have been living in dirty plastic tents and ramshackle wooden shacks at the camp since early January, when they fled there from war and devastating drought in their homeland. While their plight has been largely ignored, the fate of the ancient Buddhist monuments has drawn loud international condemnation. The Taliban announced that the so-called idols have been destroyed. And trying a new tack to drive down the price of AIDS medicines, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders has asked Yale University to permit South Africa to import a generic version of a drug on which Yale holds the patent. The university, citing a patent contract with Bristol-Myers Squibb, has refused. But the Yale press office released a brief statement last week saying Yale had removed all barriers to Bristol-Myers in making the drug readily available in South Africa and hoped it would do so.
Step by step, the longest march can be won, can be won. Many stones to form an arch, singly none, singly none. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill. Singly none, singly none. Step by step, the longest march can be won, can be won. Many stones to form an arch, singly none, singly none. And by union, what we will can be accomplished. Drops of water, drops of water, singly none, singly none, singly none, singly none.
Step by step, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we read in our top news story today, mass Zapatista rebels urge passage of an Indian rights bill after riding triumphantly into the heart of Mexico's capital in a march supported by the president and welcomed by more than 75,000 cheering supporters. The entrance capped a two-week tour of southern Mexico. And we're joined right now by Scott Gurian of community radio station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who has been following the trip and is in Mexico City right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott.
Thank you, Amy.
So can you describe to us what has been happening?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Zapatistas had begun their journey on February 25th from the city of San Cristobal de las Casas in the state of Chiapas, and they marched through a dozen Mexican states, including a weekend stopover to take part in the third National Indigenous Congress in the city of Nurillo. And finally, 2 weeks and close to 2,000 miles later, ended up in Mexico City in the Federal District. The caravan, which had grown to almost 200 buses and other vehicles of the Zapatistas and other supporters from throughout the Americas and Europe, was joined in Mexico City's central square of the Zocalo yesterday by tens of thousands of people. As you said, 75,000 or so have been the estimates. And there had actually been some talk at one point that Zapatista spokesperson Subcomandante Marcos would ride into the Zocalo on horseback and would be joined by dozens of farmers who traveled from rural provinces riding their horses and tractors. And though that didn't end up happening in the end, the arrival was still received with a lot of fanfare, as 13 buses containing the Zapatista Comandancia leadership and all the representatives of the National Indigenous Congress pulled up around mid-afternoon. In a rousing speech, Marcos thanked the millions of Mexican people for their support, and he vowed to continue the Zapatista struggle until equal rights were guaranteed for all Mexicans.
Somos y seremos uno más en la marcha.
We are and will be just one more person in the march. The march for indigenous dignity. The march of the people of the color of the earth. The march that reveals the many hidden Mexicos. We're not spokespeople, but rather a few voices among many. An echo that repeats dignity among all the voices. So those voices unite and multiply, and we will keep being an echo. We are repression and uprising. We are and always will be. There's only one thing we're looking for, the constitutional recognition of indigenous rights and culture, a place of dignity for the people of the color of the earth. It's time this country stops being dressed only in the color of money. We are rebellious because the earth rebels when it's being bought and sold like it didn't exist. And that our color, the color of the earth, didn't exist. This is the time of indigenous people of all colors, and not only the color of money. Mexico City, here we are, as the rebellious color of the earth, to shout democracy, liberty, and justice. Mexico, we're not here to tell you what to do. We're not here to guide you anywhere. We're here to ask you humbly, respectfully, not to permit another day to go by without the flag having a place for us, the people, the color of the earth.
Well, it's interesting that all that took place on the part of the Mexican government on the eve of the Zapatistas' entrance into Mexico City, to just give a bit of background on the political situation here, Vicente Fox is the first Mexican president in over 70 years who isn't from the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. So he entered office with sort of an aura of change, promising to make progress with the situation in Chiapas by honoring the demands of the Zapatistas. But most people here seem to think there's been a lot of talk, but not a lot of action to back it up. Throughout this march, the Zapatistas had three demands, what they called the Tres Enseñales, which were the passage of the San Andreas Accords for indigenous autonomy, the release of all the Zapatista political prisoners, and the withdrawal of the Mexican military from 7 of the 259 military bases in the state of Chiapas. And on the eve of these protests, we've heard about Chiapas Governor Pablo Salazar releasing all of the political prisoners in the state of Chiapas. We've heard that Fox may be close to removing the military from the rest of those 7 bases. And we've heard that actually today there will be a reexamination of the San Andreas Accords starting today between the Zapatistas and the Mexican Congress, a section of the Congress called COCOPA. So the government has acted to make it appear as though they've fulfilled everything the Zapatistas have demanded, but it should be noted that there are still hundreds of Zapatista political prisoners in other states of Mexico. There's, of course, still many military bases throughout Chiapas. As I said, 259 is the number I'd heard, and there's been actually, we've heard over the past day or so, there's been talk that Vicente Fox may be rewording the text of the San Andreas Accords to water them down more than they already are. So the Zapatistas really are quite far from achieving all of their demands, and a lot of work still needs to be done. They had started out with sort of minimal demands to begin with. So, you know, certainly there's a lot more that they would like to have accomplished. So we've arrived now in Mexico City, and just the other day before we arrived, when we stopped over in the city of San Pablo, Subcomandante Marcos had made a speech, and at the very end of his speech, he made the announcement that all of us on the caravan, he said, we'll be staying in Mexico City until our demands are met. And that was sort of a groundbreaking statement for many of us taking part in the caravan, because there hadn't been a lot of communication leading up to this. So a lot of us really didn't know what exactly would happen once we did arrive in Mexico City. And a lot of people really weren't prepared to stay here for a long time. We have no idea how long it's going to take for these accords to be ratified. For all we know, it could be a month. It could be 2 months. We really don't know. So what's going to happen now really remains to be seen.
Scott, what was the military presence like in Mexico City as the 23 rebel commanders and Subcomandante Marcos rode in the flatbed truck into the city's main plaza?
There actually wasn't that much presence on the part of the Mexican military or even Mexican police. I mean, sort of before the action, walking through the side streets, I saw plenty of buses full of Mexican police in riot gear. But during the actual action, we didn't see them out there at all. But apparently they were sort of somewhere on the sidelines, ready to come out if they thought the need was necessary.
Well, clearly a very significant day yesterday with the rebel group coming in, Zapatistas coming into Mexico City, the first time a rebel group has openly paraded in the city since Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata, the rebels' namesake, did it in 1914. We also had a chance to talk earlier today with the famed French farmer José Bové, who was invited by Marcos to join the march. We reached him at his hotel room just before he was to leave, as he explained why he came to Mexico.
Well, I'm in Mexico today because I had an invitation from Marcos to come here to be to the end of the march on Mexico. And as also, I decided to come here because as a farmer and as a member of the Campesina, which is our international organization, we decided to help and to support the Zapatista movement, because the movement is not only a movement to defend the Indians, but also a movement against globalization.
How do you see the two issues of indigenous rights and globalization connected?
I think that what we can say is that this movement to defend the Indians, the right of the Indian, the land of the Indian, the culture, is exactly the same fight we have all over the world when people try to stay and to live where they are. But globalization, free market, doesn't care about this, because the big transnational want to go, for example, in Chiapas, to take petrol, to take gas, to make a free zone near the other countries of South America. So that's why there's a problem there in Chiapas. And that's why we say that the rights of the Indians to try to have their own development where they live is exactly against free market. And that's why since 1994, there's no solutions for the Indians of Chiapas.
Were you there yesterday when the Zapatistas marched into Mexico City?
Yes, I was in the march, and so I came in Mexico with them, and I was on this very huge place with more than 500,000 people.
What was it like?
Well, it was a very, very good day. People were so happy to see all this people coming from Chiapas. There was a lot of Indians coming from also all the states of Mexico, and the people from workers, students, farmers, all of them were gathered there to say that they were making the same fight as the Indians.
José Bové, you have just come from Brazil, where you and, what was it, 1,000 landless peasants took over a Monsanto farm right next to the alternative World Economic Forum that was challenging that forum of chief executive officers with world leaders that was taking place in Davos. Can you explain what that was like and why you focused on Monsanto, what they were doing there?
Well, in the state of Rio Grande do Sul, in the south of Brazil, the government has decided that GMOs were forbidden in all that state. Not only GMOs in the wide field, but also test GMOs test. And since a few years now, 2 years, Monsanto decided to buy a farm to multiplicate his own seeds.
The genetically modified seeds.
Yeah, but that was illegal above the law of Rio Grande do Sul, because Rio Grande do Sul doesn't want GMO on his land, because they want to sell soybeans, ordinary soybeans. So the farmers decided to make this demonstration to say that Monsanto was going over the laws of that country, over the laws of that state. And that's why they decided to go in that farm. They make a symbolic occupation during 2 days, and after to have this demonstration when we put out 3 hectares of soybeans.
Uh-huh. So, in fact, it was breaking the law to be developing genetically engineered seeds there, but they said it was an experimental?
They were saying it was experimental, but their experimentations are not allowed in Rio Grande do Sul. You're not allowed to use any genetically modified seeds.
Your involvement with all of this started in the south of France, right? Can you, in a minute, explain what happened there and how you got connected to this whole movement against globalization?
Well, in 1999, 2 years ago, WTO decided to take a sentence against Europe because Europe doesn't want to buy beef treated with hormones coming from the United States and Canada.
With hormones.
Yeah. And WTO, at the same time, said to the United States that they were allowed to put some tax, 100% tax, on European products to have their money back because they couldn't sell. And so that's why they decided this. And one of those products was Roquefort cheese. And so that's why we decided to have a demonstration and to dismantle the McDonald's, which was built where we live.
So what are your plans now? You marched into Mexico City with the Zapatistas. Now what?
Well, now I'm staying here a few days in Mexico because we have some meetings with all the union farmers here because we have to to continue the fight and their fix. The next thing we're going to go is to Quebec to fight against the free market on all over the American continent.
Thank you very much for joining us, José Bové. José Bové, the French farmer who rose to fame 2 years ago after he and some of his friends in southern France hammered on the golden arches of a McDonald's. He was then in Seattle at the Battle of Seattle down in Brazil and now speaking to us from Mexico City, where Subcomandante Marcos invited him to join the march of the Zapatistas into the capital. And we will continue to cover that story as it develops. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Special thanks to Scott Gurian reporting for us on the scene from station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back, Critical Resistance East with Angela Davis, Asada Shakur, and others. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Critical Resistance, that conference in Berkeley in 1998, which attracted close to 4,000 people and established a framework for a new movement against the prison industrial complex. Well, it came to New York this weekend. Around 2,600 people participated in an estimated 100 plenaries, panels, and workshops. The highlight came on Saturday night when the massive Riverside Church in Harlem was filled to capacity for a collaborative performance called Women, Prison, Globalization, and Resistance, featuring Angela Davis and others. Today, we're going to hear selections from that performance, beginning with Asada Shakur. Asada Shakur has been living in Cuba for the last 15 years since 1986, after she escaped from a U.S. prison where she was serving a life sentence imposed in a highly disputed trial. Shakur was a Black Panther, then in the Black Liberation Army in the early 70s, a target of the FBI's counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO. A shootout occurred after police stopped the car in which she was riding in 1973 on the New Jersey State Turnpike. A state trooper and one of Shakur's fellow activists was killed. Assata Shakur herself was seriously wounded. Several years later, Assata Shakur escaped and has been living ever since in Cuba. Part of the performance piece on Saturday night was a recorded phone call with her in Cuba set to music.
Anybody. They are criminals. How is a criminal going to rehabilitate somebody? So I think that we have got to educate ourselves and prepare ourselves to fight a repressive system, an oppressive system, and a system that smashes the human being to the point where people don't even remember how to take a walk, how to say good morning, how to smile at each other. We have to take this planet back from the beasts that are controlling it right now. I escaped from prison in 1979. And since 1979, the population of women in prison has tripled. It boggles my mind, and it should boggle everybody's mind who understands mathematics. More and more poor women, because there are no rich women, no rich people in prison. So you're dealing with poor women, you're dealing with poor mothers, you're dealing with African, Asian, Latin American, and indigenous women who are in those prisons are being dehumanized, just snatched up off the street, given all kinds of time. And I think that it is important for women to be activists in dealing with women in prison and freeing women in prison and freeing women who are political prisoners, because there are quite a few women who are political prisoners. And I also think that the women's movement needs to deal with those women and to have outreach programs, support programs for those women who are in prison, to help them be united with their children, with their families. Because what is happening is there are a whole lot of children out there that have no mother, no father, that are being just thrown out into the street. So I say that if you call yourself a woman that identifies with the liberation of women, then identify with the most oppressed, exploited women in the United States. I mean, because I'll be real with you. You know, one of the most, just raging pains that I had was being separated from my child, was being forbidden to hold her, to touch her, to breastfeed her. The condition of women in prison in the United States is unbearable. I mean, I have seen women who have given birth and they have not been able to even see their children. Social workers can tell women if their children can visit them or not. I was in prisons where it was forbidden for children to visit. The Middlesex County Workhouse where I was, it was pathetic. It tore your insides out. You see all these little children outside trying to scream and yell at their mothers. They couldn't see their mothers. It was the most frustrating thing, the most heartbreaking thing that I've ever seen. So I think that anybody who has any human sensibility, who has any commitment to women, needs to get involved in liberating women in prison, in providing support, education, job training, etc., for those sisters who are in prison.
And that was Angela Davis. So that was Assata Shakur speaking from Cuba, where she has been since 1986. And that from a performance that was part of the Critical Resistance Conference that took place this past weekend in New York. One of the keynote speakers was Angela Davis. Her history is a very significant one. While at the University of California at San Diego, Davis became a member of the Communist Party in 1968, as well as a member of the Black Panthers. In 1970, Angela Davis became only the third woman in history to appear on the FBI's most wanted list, charged with conspiracy to free George Jackson with a bloody shootout in front of a courthouse in California. The FBI asserted that Davis armed prisoners in Marin County Courthouse with guns that were registered in her name. After fleeing for 2 weeks, she was captured, charged with murder and kidnapping, even though she didn't actually take part in the shootout. Davis spent 16 months behind bars until her subsequent acquittal on all charges. Today, Angela Davis continues to be a strong force for political and social activism, as well as the reformation of the prison industrial complex. She is a professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz and also spoke on Saturday night at Riverside Church in New York.
Whereas the space inside women's prisons within and beyond the United States is expanding, we gather here this evening to imagine and work toward a withering away of this space of violence and repression, this space that constitutes the women who inhabit it as insignificant and invisible. And so on this International Women's Day weekend, we send out a toast to celebrate the recent release of Linda Evans and Susan Rosenberg, and Kimba Smith, and Dorothy Gaines. But why was Marilyn Buck passed over? And why didn't Clinton pardon Lynette Peltier? About the continued imprisonment, political imprisonment of Marilyn Buck, whose words you have heard this evening, could it possibly have something to do with Governor Christine Whitman and her campaign against Assata Shakur, whose words you have also heard this evening? Assata, whom Marilyn was charged with assisting to escape from prison. Imprisonment, and especially the recent developments of ever more repressive regimes of punishment. Imprisonment pathologizes human beings, and regardless of what issues the person may have faced at the beginning of her imprisonment, that the prison itself inevitably causes emotional instability and mental disorder. Most women we know go to prison on petty charges. Drug-related charges are, of course, the most prevalent. And if after they're taken to prison, they find it difficult to adjust, they end up in ADSEG, or the SHU, in places that are sometimes called adjustment centers. Who wouldn't find it hard to adjust to prison? Could you? As one prisoner put it, try living in your bathroom, or in this small space marked out on the stage. Prison regimes are gendered and sexualized, often in anachronistic ways. For example, healthcare in women's prisons is non-existent. There's often a refusal to take women's healthcare needs seriously because women are seen as always complaining unnecessarily, and thus as hypochondriacs. And putative healthcare providers find that the space for health services is also designed to encourage sexual abuse. For example, the women at Valley State who said that they received pelvic exams regardless of their medical problems, even when they had headaches. Because the women's prison is a female space, lesbian baiting is a constant aspect of prison regimes. physical touch becomes sexualized, and those women who are lesbians find themselves targets of the repressive practices of the prison administration. On this International Women's Day weekend, an occasion of solidarity with women workers, we extend our solidarity to those women workers behind walls. Those women workers who are rarely the beneficiaries of other workers' solidarity. And how many of you are union members here this evening? I think every union member, myself included, should be prepared to say we extend our solidarity to you, our sisters, as unemployed workers, as workers behind walls, and especially to those women who are educating their peers about the way their bodies and their labor are exploited by transnational corporations and the state, whose destructive embrace we call the prison industrial complex. And so this is a moment for solidarity. This is a moment for solidarity with women. This is a moment for solidarity with women of color, with poor women. This is not a moment for pity. This is not a moment for condescension, but a moment for solidarity that refuses to recognize the borders separating the free world from the world of the prison. This evening is about solidarity and power and resistance and the potential for radical transformation.
And that was Angela Davis speaking at the Critical Resistance Conference. She was followed by Suher Hamed, who is a Palestinian author who performed this reading.
Always loved criminals. I tell people who try to shame me into silence with words like television, conjugal, college, doctors, libraries, they say. Can you imagine a library in a Nigerian, a Chinese, a Colombian prison? Do you know what happens in other parts of the world? Americans are spoiled. No idea how. We are here. Even you often write how your time has offered reflection, meditation, deepened your faith, but you are 27 and have 10 years to go nowhere. And how much deeper are you going to get? Until a system based on money deems you rehabilitated. I have always loved criminals. And the way you bomb my tag, Butter Phoenix, all across your letters reminds me our affirmation is considered vandalism. I have always loved criminals. And not only the thugged out bravado of rap videos and champagne popping hustlers, but my mother, born Palestinian and breathing was illegal. My father, born an Arab baby, boy on the forced way out of his homeland, his mother exiled and pregnant, gave birth in a camp. The world pointed and said, Palestinians do not exist. Palestinians are roaches. Palestinians are two-legged animals. And Israel built jails and weapons and a history based on the absence of a people. Israel made itself holy and chosen, and my existence a crime. So I have always loved criminals. It is an act. It is a love of self. and I will not cut off any part of me and place it behind fences and bars and the fake-ass belief that there is a difference between the inside and the outside. There is no outside anywhere anymore, just where we are and what we do while we are here. And there are people, Anthony, who make a connection between you, Puerto Rican rhyme slayer, beautiful man, and young girls twisted into sex work. And these people, Nazim, they are working to stop prisons from being economically beneficial to depressed communities. And these people, Bronx Bomber, they have never heard you spit your lyrics. But they imagine a world where money can't be made off the hurt of the young, the poor, the colored, the sexualized, the different. They have never heard you flow, Nymphlo, and they can't see the brilliance of your cut from these mere words. But these people, 4-2-8-5-1-0-5-4-5-8-1-2. These people, they believe human beings can never be reduced to numbers, not in concentration camps or reservations, not in refugee camps, not in our schools, and not in jails. These people, brother, they resist. I will share these words with them on Saturday, March 10th, 2001, and I will do it in your name and the name of all those who resist and imagine. Stay well and safe. Resist. Love, Suher.
Suher Hamed, a Palestinian-American author raised in Brooklyn, her book, Drops of the Story, tells the tale of the growing pains of a young woman of color as she tries to write herself into existence, reading on Saturday night at the Critical Resistance East Conference at Riverside Church in New York. When we come back, we'll hear from Marsha Darling, historian and director of the Center for African American and Ethnic Studies at Adelphi University, as well as more from Angela Davis. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we play you excerpts of the weekend's Critical Resistance East Conference that took place in New York with close to 3,000 people in attendance. On Saturday night, again, Angela Davis, professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz, a key member of the Critical Resistance movement, spoke.
We refer to the prison industrial complex in order to point to the sinister alliances that link increasing numbers of private corporations to the state apparatus of punishment. As we are learning this weekend, punishment is profitable in multiple ways. Imprisonment is increasingly central to the U.S. economy, and its architectures, its technologies, its tortures, its ideologies travel along the circuits of global capital. The massive growth of women's prison populations in the U.S., the increasing profitability of prisons, and women's prisons in particular, gets translated across national borders and often gets transplanted outright. This is why women's prisons seem so much the same wherever we are, in Stockholm, Sweden, or Brasilia, Brazil, in Chowchilla, California, or Bedford Hills, New York, or Rosario, Argentina. For a couple of years, we've been talking about that women's private prison in Australia, the prison outside Melbourne, that is the largest women's prison in Australia. that prison that was owned and operated by Correction Corporation of America, headquartered in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, today we can celebrate a victory. We can celebrate resistance on the global landscape, because the anti-prison movement in Australia has forced the government to withdraw from its contract with CCA. They have sent CCA running back to Nashville. But it seems to me that we need to take on Sodexo Marriott a little bit stronger. This victory in Australia is wonderful. But we have to ask the question, are we satisfied? Do we want to replace private prisons with government prisons? And as you know, critical resistance is determined to stop the building of new prisons. And in California, critical resistance has filed a lawsuit against the California Department of Corrections to prevent the building of a new prison in Delano. Yes, critical resistance beyond the prison industrial complex. Talk about dismantling private prisons all over the world. Let's talk about the decarceration of public prisons. And let's talk about abolitionism, death penalty abolitionism, free mumia, and prison abolitionism. And in order to move forward in this abolitionist project, we need to resolutely resist the policies and practices of our newly selected president and the capitalist corporations and social structures and ideologies that inform our communities, our cultures, our lives. We intend to creatively forge solidarity. We intend to critique and resist. We intend to learn how to engage in the practice of freedom.
Angela Davis, speaking at the Critical Resistance Conference. Among those who addressed workshops was Marcia Darling, historian and director of the Center for African American and Ethnic Studies at Adelphi University, talking about the relationship between globalization and privatization of prisons.
So this is an age where the issue is the movement of massive amounts of money across national boundaries, the attempt to water down, mute, distill, weaken national protection laws, such as the ones that do exist here. Now, what does that have to do with prisons? Because I want to focus here on something that we're talking about today. This move to privatize the prisons fits into the globalization in one important way. Privatized prisons mean the ability to move prisoners across state boundaries, and we're already seeing that happen. So at least you think that's just somebody sitting around who's just recently thought about privatizing prisons and therefore making prisons into global production centers. At least you think they've just started thinking about that. Go back, read more about the evolution of this idea of elite global management, and you'll begin to see where large incarcerated prison populations, in fact, are envisioned as financially productive production centers. Mm-hmm. Now, for that to happen, several things have to happen. One, the boundaries between states have to become more fluid. Prisoners from Hawaii have to be taken to Georgia. Prisoners from New Jersey have to be taken to empty facilities in Texas. Two, local governance and state governance protections, however weak they are, have to be further weakened, so that whatever human rights protections and civil rights protections we have traditionally thought important to surround prisoners with and press the prisons to enforce, those also have to be weakened and diluted. And this is principally done through two vehicles. One, of course, the movement, the process of creating more and more and more laws that deregulate the regulations that we had put in place over the past 30 years that were quite protective of civil rights. But the other way, the other level in which this is important, is that groups like the WTO and NAFTA sit down and develop global trade agreements. And when a local town in South Carolina or a county in Utah decides that they, that a particular set of rules and regulations violate their local governances, well, then that particular worldwide organization, WTO or NAFTA, can sue that local county or that local town. Now, you and I both know that local county or town doesn't have the financial resources to go up against the WTO or NAFTA or any large global management, economic management group, and so they often cave in, settle out of court. It never comes to litigation, and all, it's over. The point is that what has been accomplished is the gradual weakening and erosion of local systems of governance and control. That's the goal with privatization. Now, most of you weigh in on this, actually, maybe not with the prison issue, but with genetically modified foods, right? Because those of you that are on the edge of this know that what we're also being told is that the corporations should be, the, namely the chemical companies, should be able to produce corn, Starlink corn, that looks like corn, but that in fact is genetically modified. Now, as Americans, we've been eating this now for 5 or 6 years. Most of the corn in the country's breadbasket at this point, or wheat, corn areas, is contaminated. This past week, the FDA weighed in to say that it had purchased some large number of pure, unmodified seed, meaning once the genetically engineered crop is planted and spring time comes and it pollinates, the bees and the birds carry, and the wind, carry those pollination molecules to other fields. So that even if you're an organic farmer in the next field over, you've not grown any Ready Roundup potatoes or Starlink corn, your crop becomes contaminated, and the chemical company comes after you, accuses you of now growing a crop that's like theirs, and agreeing to settle with you for a sum in an out-of-court litigation. So if you look at, you know, there are a number of examples of this. Privatizing eugenics, that is making reproductive control a matter of the provider, the medical, the nurse, or the doctor, putting the device in or installing it, or the anti-fertility vaccine. The process of having someone outside of a woman's body determine the length and the depth of contraceptive inability to conceive. So there are a number of examples. I just want you to fit this into globalization, that's where this emphasis, this hard, heavy-duty push on privatizing and therefore moving away from whatever kinds of common good laws, common good regulations we had worked for the past 50, 60 years to put in place. Notice how those are the very boundaries that are being pushed up against and weakened or collapsed.
Marcia Darling, director of the Center for African American and Ethnic Studies at Adelphi University, also at the conference Critical Resistance Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex, was songwriter Sai Khan, well-known civil rights and union organizer for the last 30 years in the South.
I was hiding in the brush by the Ohio River, Sarah by my side, the baby in my arms. When the slave catchers found us with our backs against the water, winter come late and the ice not formed, and they sold me back south to the old Van plantation, 200 miles from my home and kin, to be buried in a grave with no marker on it, right on the spot where the new prison stands, right on the spot where the new prison stands. I was walking the streets by the Anacostia River, but no one was hiring a young black man, when the district police picked me up for no reason, gave me 15 years for less than 10 grams, and they sent me down south to the old Van plantation, 200 miles from my home and kin, to be buried in a cell in a for-profit prison to make some men rich from the trouble I'm in. To make some men rich from the trouble I'm in. There were 4 million slaves from the African nation. Now there's 2 million prisoners in the land of the free. It might be right on this spot that my great-great-grandmother had done to her what they're doing to me. I can feel her spirit on the old Van plantation, beneath the towers and the razor wire, all for the profit of some prison corporation. If you say that's not slavery, you're a goddamn liar. If you say that's not slavery, you're a goddamn liar. It's a true story. I wish it weren't a true story. The Old Van Plantation was one of the largest slave plantations in eastern North Carolina back in the early 1800s. It's now the property of the Wackenhut Corrections Corporation, which this week is bringing the first shipments of young African-American men from the District of Columbia to be imprisoned there. We're talking about low security. We are talking about nonviolent. We are talking about minimal drug offenses. And that's just the tip of an iceberg that's heading down on all of us. The idea that you can imprison people in order to make money off of them is not new in this country's history. And the precedents are not only slavery, but the convict lease system, which followed slavery, under which prisoners were leased at a dollar a day to corporations, which worked them so brutally that in every year that that system existed in the 19th century, 1 out of 3 prisoners died every year. But we have not had, in the last 70 or 80 years, the idea directly put into place that you can build a prison, that Kamayu and I can go out in a cornfield somewhere and build a prison without any government authorization, without any public notice, that we can just build a prison and we can hire this new job called a bed broker and we can say, Dan, we've got 1,500 slots. We'll do it for $35 per prisoner per day. You get 4 for every day we keep them in. If you can get us 40, that's great. If you have to get us 30, that's fine, but we will take them. And we'll take them from anywhere. We'll take them from Alaska. We'll take them from Hawaii. I'm talking real examples. We are fighting a prison right now in southwest Georgia where the Corrections Corporation of America is trying to bring 1,500 Hawaiians, mostly native Hawaiians, to South Georgia. Now, what do you do if you are the child or the parent or the partner or the spouse or the friend or the lover or the neighbor or the religious community or the neighborhood of someone who goes to prison 10,000 miles from home? And if you're poor yourself, you don't get on an airplane and see them. When they leave, do you ever see them again? But this is what happens when the power of capital and the power of profit drives prison policy. So we are here, actually all of us here, are involved in the public safety and justice campaign, although we'll be talking about different things here today, which is one part of the struggle for justice. And it's the part that seeks to abolish for-profit private prisons. Here's our mission statement. It says, for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers have no place in a democratic society.
Sai Khan, among many others who gathered this weekend at Columbia University Law School for the Critical Resistance East Conference, Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!